Hi, all, and welcome back to The Stacks. My name is Tracy Thomas, and I am your host here. I'm so excited to have you guys back this week. I have a really awesome episode with Tony-nominated choreographer Sam Pinkleton. Before we get started, I just wanted to remind you all, Audible is our sponsor here, and they have an amazing offer for any listener of The Stacks. You get a free 30-day trial and free audiobook download if you go to audibletrial.com/thestacks. They have over 180,000 book titles, so I'm pretty sure there is something there for you. This week, I'm joined by Broadway Tony-nominated choreographer Sam Pinkleton. He's most well-known for his work on Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, which was on Broadway about a year ago. He's here in LA working on a brand new production called Soft Power, which we discuss in detail, which is at the Amundsen in Los Angeles. Sam and I also talk about how books work as a source of creativity, and also how reading and research helps to inspire Sam's creative process. We also talk about the power of really well done true crime, which we both are huge fans of. So we geek out a little bit over that. As always, we will be sure to put all of the books we talk about, all the articles and TV shows and pop culture references in the show notes. So you don't have to worry about writing everything down. They're there for you in the show notes and also on our website, which is www.thestackspodcast.com. Okay, so let's talk. I'm so excited for y'all to hear my conversation with Sam Pinkleton. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to The Stacks. I am here today with my guest, Sam Pinkleton. Sam is a choreographer and director and just generally amazing New York City theater person. And I'm so excited because he's in town choreographing a show at the Amundsen called Soft Power. But that's all I can say. And Sam, why don't you just say hi and introduce yourself?
Hi, Tracy. Thanks for having me.
I'm so excited. Go ahead. Talk about yourself. It's
oh
so easy.
God, talk about myself. Yeah, I work in the theater mostly, which is obviously what brings you to LA.
Right. Duh.
Love to come to LA to make as much theater as possible because this city really big on theater.
Huge.
Nope.
Nope.
I'm excited to be here.
Let's see. If you haven't seen Soft Power yet, which basically nobody has because it opens soon. It actually opens today if you're listening to the podcast on Wednesday, May 16th. But you were nominated for a Tony Award.
I was.
Tell us about that and the show.
Being nominated for a Tony Award is like being nominated for prom queen. It is so bizarre and awesome, and I don't want to make it a small thing. It's a big thing. It's a dream coming true. And also it basically just means that you have to spend like 5 weeks eating chicken breasts in formal wear.
Amazing.
And like just like going to Topshop every day to try to get like more like cheap jackets because you have to go to all of these events
and look different.
And look different
and get like your picture taken.
Yeah, basically like campaign.
Got it.
It's an enormous pie eating contest that was delightful and completely ridiculous.
And what show were you nominated for choreography, Tony?
I was nominated for Natasha, Pierre, and the Great Comet of 1812, which we did last year on the Broadway. It was a great, 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 tremendous joy to be a part of.
Yeah, Sam has done some really cool stuff. So I, of course, will link to everything he talks about today in the show notes, and I'll link to him too so you can kind of look up his amazing career history. So Sam's a choreographer. And if you don't know what a choreographer is, which like...
I don't.
I do because I have a brain. No. Dancing. You're in charge of dancing, movement, people generally on the stage.
Yeah, I keep people from running into each other, and sometimes I get to make dance moves.
Sometimes it's dancing, sometimes it's just telling actors, like, keep walking till you get there.
Yeah, watch out for the edge of the stage, you guys.
Have you ever had someone fall off the front of the stage?
No, but I have had people run into things in ways that you're like, how
did you not
how
see that?
Are you allowed on stage?
But weren't you maybe then kind of proud of your performer for being, like, so in it?
Yeah.
Or were you more like... How did you graduate kindergarten?
No, I definitely encourage a certain recklessness in performers, which sometimes backfires.
Sure, sure. Okay, so take us through how it works. How do you even get to be a choreographer of something? Like, does a director come find you? Do you have an agent? Like, how does that work?
The answer is yes to all of those things.
Okay.
I mean, because I don't have a dance background, it is very odd that I have made the life that I have
right.
As a professional dance maker because I was never a dancer.
Right. Well, you danced.
I enjoy dancing.
Sure.
But I could not give you like a pointed foot.
That's also true.
As you may know.
As I know.
So it is, you know, I think of myself as a collaborator. You know, I don't work in the concert dance world. I work in theater. And so, you know, when somebody needs something to become a little magic or 5, 6, 7, 8 or, you know, whatever the thing is, I get that call. The process of making it though is often less about dancing and more about research and more about understanding, you know, why does there need to be a choreographer? Why does there need to be dancing? Like, what is the world of this thing?
And how do you do that research?
Well, since we're on this book podcast.
Oh, what a segue. Can we talk about books?
I guess so. No, I actually do. I mean, I'm obsessed with research mostly because it keeps me from having to actually make anything.
Got it.
And I find the act of making stuff, particularly choreography, to be so utterly paralyzing and mm-hmm. terrifying. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of any process, whether it's a giant musical or a 10-second, you know, toothpaste commercial, okay. the first thing I will do is figure out kind of like what reading will help me understand the assignment or the world of it or the things that it's dealing with. And then I will make like the biggest, campiest YouTube playlist
okay.
that feels like a sort of a buffet of references for the project.
Okay.
But lately, as I've been kind of working on these more expansive and ambitious sort of large-scale projects, some sort of base reading has been really, really helpful. And pretty much every show I do, there's like 3 or 4 or 30 books that feel like foundational texts for me.
Just based on whatever the show is.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, Soft Power, which I barely know anything about, but I do know that it has to do with the American experience, the American dream, but also as seen through the Chinese lens. So what are some things that maybe you read for this?
Yeah. So I mean, Soft Power is aggressively about the moment that we're living in right now. Okay. It is, in a sentence, it's basically a reversal of The King and I that is a fantasy version of the story about China swooping in to rescue America after the collapse of democracy following the 2016 election. And
it's funny.
It's very funny. Okay. And it's about China becoming a global superpower.
Okay.
And it's also a love story between a Chinese film executive and the American rebel leader, whose name is, of course, Hillary Clinton.
Oh, of course.
So it was, as a choreographer, it was a lot of video research and a lot of like really ridiculous, like campy, fun movement research. But I also kind of wanted to get a sense of like how we are talking about this moment as mythology.
Mm-hmm.
Like in, because the musical is, we are to believe, was created in the future, looking back okay. on the moment that we're in right now.
Got it.
So it's like, what are, in 100 years, what will we be like? Like, what was 2016 like? What was 2018? Like, what were people talking about? So I've actually made it a big project for myself to read the kind of very buzzy books
okay.
That are coming out like too fast and too furious right now.
Okay.
The headlines being, of course, like the James Comey book that just came out.
The Hillary book.
And of course,
Fire and Fury.
not only just because they're a delight, but also just to understand sort of how we are wrapping this moment that we're currently living up into right. a story. You know, like, what is this story going to be for the future?
Sure. And that's actually really interesting to think about text as they come out, especially nonfiction, like especially things that are current, to think about them as being the historical record,
right?
Because in 20 years, when people look back and they read that Hillary book, it will be the historical text of what 2016 was, even if in 20 years from now, we think about 2016 differently.
Right. I mean, it is the mythology that we're creating.
Sure.
And they're also they're coming out so quickly. Like all three of those books, I would say, like by the time I read them, which was almost immediately after they came out, there were things about them that felt dated.
Sure.
It's like, oh, this piece of information no longer rings.
And especially with the way that the news cycle, it just gets faster and faster, which, not to segue too much, but just to throw out, Sam and I read for book club for next week, Vulgar Favors, which is a book about the assassination of Gianni Versace and Andrew Cannan. And I know something that I plan to talk to Sam about is that how dated the book feels now in 2018 when it was written in 1999. So it's interesting to think like that's always been a thing, but a lot of these kind of books, we read them right away and then we kind of never look back on them because they seem dated. Like the thought of reading the Hillary book now, I'm kind of like, that was 2 years ago.
For
like,
sure.
Who cares?
Well, and it's amazing when you think about like what books in that genre do endure, like what actually can you look
like
back
the autobiography of like Malcolm X.
Oh my gosh,
or Nelson Mandela's A Long Walk, something like that. I have it. A Long Walk to Freedom. I'm looking at it right now. Thank you, Bookshelf, for always being there for me. Okay. So that's interesting. Did you do any reading about China itself as a global superpower or its history or anything?
Yeah, of course. I
cover my bases.
Sure. the thing about this idea of China, so soft power is a very real concept that I think we're hearing more and more about every day in the news. Some people are like, yeah, obviously soft power. And some people are like, what does that mean?
I've never heard that phrase.
Soft power is influence that is not necessarily attached to money or weapons.
Okay.
So culture, largely culture. America has so much soft power.
Right.
China has less soft power. Many say because of course, the restrictions and censorship and the sort of tightness of culture.
Sure.
I cannot claim to be a scholar of Chinese economics or culture.
Perfect.
But I have done some, I've been immersed in this.
Sure.
It is such a rapidly developing conversation because every day the China and America relationship becomes more complicated, and also China's rise as a, if not the global superpower, is getting more intense by the day. So it's the internet and it's magazines. I mean, if you look at this month's Atlantic, New Yorker, and Time magazine, there are all articles that are like, the headline is basically like, will China become the world leader in soft power?
Oh,
like this month.
That's so interesting. So, we have the Atlantic, we subscribe, and I just haven't picked it up yet this month.
It's pretty wild. I mean, I think like to the point of like the mythology we're creating, like I think in a year, everybody's going to be walking around being like, oh my gosh, China has so much soft power. But right now people are like, soft power? Is that
it's
like
kind of like when Black Twitter came out and people are like, Black Twitter? Is like the bird black? And now everyone's like, Black Twitter, duh.
Yep, exactly.
Okay, that's interesting.
Or it just sounds like a brand of sheets currently.
Yeah, soft power, sure. Yeah. I'm so into it. Okay, so I actually do have kind of a specific question for you about your creative process. Are there any books or texts that you go back to or use every time or often when you're creating that are books about the creative process itself? Like, are there things that kind of inspire you, or books, or it doesn't have to be a book, a movie, a TV show, songs, or something that are kind of like your safe place? Because you said it can be kind of paralyzing to create. So are there things that you kind of, rituals or anything like that, that helps you to do that?
There definitely are. There's a few. There's a few books that were kind of foundational for me that I return to when I'm panicking. one is one that I think is a very common answer for people who do what I do, which is Twyla Tharp's book, The Creative Habit.
I loved that book so much.
It's real. And it's amazing because, she's a legend. I do not always connect to her work, but the way that she sort of systematizes process and acknowledges that we are all like staring into a void of terror is so helpful and meaningful. And the idea of actually just like creating structures to move through that, no matter how you feel, I highly recommend it.
And her work, you've never seen like her stuff, like Moving Out.
Oh my God.
I saw it three times on Broadway. I died. I saw it. Like, it was my favorite. People, listeners, hi, welcome to the show. You might not know this about me, but I was a dancer once, and I am a lover of dance. I just love it.
You're a dance icon for me, Tracy Thomas. So
it's true. I used to choreograph Sam. So I am a choreographer of a Tony nominated choreographer, which makes me a Tony nominated choreographer.
I think you're double nominated. Yeah.
I am a winner. But Twyla Tharp's, to have watched her work and then to have read the book, it really speaks to the power of committing to the creative process
and rigor, and just and, like, you have to like sweat and work, and it's not
easy. Not fun sometimes.
And also, like, I'm such a believer. I always say this to people that I'm working with. Like, I don't know that I actually believe in things like inspiration or even creativity.
Sure.
Like, I kind of think those words are fake. Like, the thing I believe in is like putting in the work,
right?
And like continuously being in motion. Sure. And I think that book especially just like really. It demystifies the whole thing.
You don't believe in creativity? You're one of the most creative people that I know, which is maybe why, because maybe you don't see it.
I just don't believe in like staring at a cloud and being like, I know how to do it now. I feel, sure. I just think that rigor is real. Like, I think that creativity as an idea is really dangerous because I think it sometimes can let you off the hook.
Sure.
And it is part of why I love kind of books that are about unpacking, or it's just like making that less oogie boogie, you know?
Right. Okay. Because, yeah, you're very creative. But I guess what you're saying is like you believe more of like just you put a thing in motion and you just keep adjusting it and like you keep doing the work over and over until it just clicks for that moment. And if you had more time, maybe you would keep changing it.
Yeah. And it might be terrible right away. And then there's like a process to that.
Yeah. People don't know this. And especially about the theater, it's terrible in the beginning.
It's always humiliating.
Bad. And if it's good in the beginning, it's bad when it opens.
And if you feel great about what you're doing, that is a giant warning sign.
Yeah. Which I think maybe translates to other art forms and maybe other parts of work and stuff like that. But if you feel really good about something in the theater, it's bound to be ruined.
I think it's definitely true. I mean, actually, to your question, one of the other books that's really important to me is this book, Interviews with Francis Bacon, who is a painter, an amazing painter.
Okay.
And it's basically just him talking about his process. And it's the same thing. Like, it's about being like gripped with terror. Sure. And also he talks a lot about like if he makes a painting, what is the thing that he actually wants you to see? And like often he'll just like put an arrow next to the thing that he wants you to see just to make sure that you see it.
Are you seeing this thing?
Yeah, which I just like love. Like I love the sort of obviousness in that part of making work.
Right.
So I try not to just be in the land of, you know, dance makers and theater makers because I think ultimately, first of all, everybody has a creative impulse.
Right.
And also we're all just like struggling with the same crazy shit on this planet.
Right. Right. That's so true.
Can I say crazy shit on this podcast?
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, listen, I love to swear more than anything in this world. So yeah.
I'm sorry.
I don't care. I think we're explicit. If we're not, I'll make sure this one is. okay. So I'm really excited. So just a little background. Before I ever launched an episode of this podcast and I came up with this idea, I said to myself, who do I want to have on the show? And the first person I thought of was Sam Pinkleton. And you might say, why? Why have a weirdo choreographer on? And the reason is because Sam and I knew each other long ago when we went to college in New York and we created a book club. And besides the Stax book club, it is the only book club I've ever been in. And you might think, wow, they created a book club and invited all their friends.
Nope.
We created a book club for two people, which is actually the basis of the Stax podcast, which is I don't want to have a book club where I have to hear from Nancy because Nancy didn't even read the book, first of all.
She read the Wikipedia.
Yeah. Nancy got the Cliff Notes. And she also like didn't ever want to read the book. So she walked in with her like deviled eggs and her bad attitude.
Yeah.
So instead, Sam and I picked books that we wanted to read. We did not tell Nancy. We also ate at Chipotle almost every single time.
That's right.
And we discussed books. And books that nobody else wanted to read, like books about death.
Books about cults.
Books about cults. Books about religion. I think maybe we read one fiction ever, and I don't even know if that's true.
I don't remember.
I don't remember a fiction. Okay. We didn't read any fiction, and we just lived our best lives. So with all that being said, I brought Sam here. He's pretending like he's in LA to do soft power, but really he's here to do the Stax.
That's right.
Yes. Yes, all expenses.
Soft power is subsidizing my work on the Stax.
Exactly. So let's get started talking about books. We'll start with one of my favorite questions. What are two books you love?
Two books that I love. This is impossible, but the books that immediately came to mind are Christopher Isherwood's Berlin Stories.
Oh, which Cabaret, right?
Is the basis for the musical Cabaret. Ugh. But that's what people always say, but it's so much more than that. Like, that is a little glimmer of it. It's basically just like a book about like a young queer guy in a crazy world getting his shit like shaken up, right. Which we can all connect to.
And you read that book in Berlin, right? Or Amsterdam.
The first time I read that book, and this is a huge part of why it's so meaningful to me. The first time I read that book, I was like a 21-year-old kid in Berlin.
I remember that.
And it's such a cliche.
Sure.
But it's also how books form who we are.
Yeah.
And you know, I think I've read it a few times, and every time I come back to it, it's not only such a wonderful book, but it reminds me of who I was at that time. Mm. And it articulated much better than I ever could some of the experiences of being like a kid coming of age,
sure.
Especially a queer kid.
Sure. You know, there's an article from the New York Times, and they talk about reading books at a specific time in your life and how it's important and how you can read a book too soon or too late for who you are. Like reading The Catcher in the Rye at like 50 is not necessarily like when that book was meant for people
to read. You have to read that book your senior year of high school.
Yeah, I read it a little late and I hate it.
Well, and I think there's a lot of books that I love and I think of as being my favorite books that if I return to them now, I would actually be kind of right. Like embarrassed.
I've heard that a lot. I just read Wrinkle in Time for the first time, and a lot of people said that they reread it and they didn't like it.
Yeah.
I didn't like it, but I'm in my 30s.
Right.
And like, okay, cool. Glad that this little, I understand that the book is important for what it was at the time, a female author writing about a female protagonist, child, smart, little girl in science fiction. And to all of that, I say like, yes, please.
Yeah.
But I was like, this book sucks.
Yeah, that's I think a lot of the important books from pre-20 would be tricky now.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too. Okay, sorry. What's your second book?
The second book, this is just like a white guy fest, and I'm really sorry.
It's
but
okay.
The second book that came to mind is The Hours by Michael Cunningham.
I never read that.
I don't know that I would love it if I returned to it. I've read, but it is... it's one of the first books that I really loved that does my favorite thing, which is have a story that takes place in multiple times with protagonists over, you know, in completely different times, kind of overlapping and living on top of each other and within each other. And it is the thing that I'm sort of obsessed with as a theater maker, of presenting a completely implausible time situation and having that carry like so much meaning. And it's like a kind of about Virginia Woolf, who was a badass. And it's kind of about Mrs. Dalloway, and it's about, you know, sexual repression and suburban panic.
You're into it.
Yeah.
And do you reread books often?
Not often, but I definitely will reread the books that I think are the most profound. Or if I'm working on a project and I'm like, oh my God, this reminds me of this thing that I read for pleasure, I will read it with an eye towards, you know, work.
Sure. And how does that change your eye towards work? How does it change your reading?
It's just, I feel like if I'm reading something for pleasure, I'm reading it for pleasure. And if I'm reading it for work, I'm sort of interrogating it.
Got it.
You know, I'll read things more than once. I take a lot more notes. It should probably be the same thing, but, you know, I love to suffer.
Sure. Okay. Please tell me you have an answer for this next question. What's a book you hate?
I hate On the Road. I hate Jack Kerouac's On the Road, and I am so not ashamed to say it. I think it is the most boring. It's so boring.
Thank you for hating a book publicly.
Oh my God. And it also, like, it's one of those books that was continuously presented to me as like, oh my God, you're gonna love On the Road. It's about you. It's bohemian. It's the East Village. And I was like, if this is what people think I am like, I hate all of these people.
Or do you just hate yourself?
I super hate myself. But that's beside the point. I just cannot understand how that book has the love that it has. I think it is the most like limited experience of being alive. It's also just like, it doesn't account for anybody other than like one white guy with some change in his pocket.
Okay.
Which is funny because the book that I love so much is also about one white guy with some change in his pocket. But
just got to depend on how you make that white guy white, I guess. What kind of white?
How You Make That White Guy White by Tracy Thomas.
That's my memoir. It's coming out fall 2020. No big deal. You know, a lot of people come on the show and they're scared to say a book they hate.
Oh, I have,
Lists. I know you do. Me too.
Come on. That's life is short. That's why we have a book club. Yeah. Know your taste. It's so good to know what you hate.
Yeah. Hating a book, I think, says as much about the books you love and about you as loving a book.
Yeah.
Okay. What's the last great book you read?
I am embarrassed to say that I kind of loved the Comey book, but I don't know that I will think of it as a great book.
Okay.
I don't think in 5 years I'll look back on it as a great book. The last great book that I read is actually the Lindy West's memoir. If you know Lindy West, she's like an amazing, amazing comedian and writer. And the title of the book is escaping me right now.
I'll put it in the show notes. Don't worry.
Great. She's an overweight comedian who has come from a kind of amazing background. And this is a maybe lame thing to say, but her experience of moving through the world as a person who is shaped differently was, I would say, as heartbreaking and hilarious and illuminating as reading a book about somebody from a culture that you understand nothing about.
Sure.
And that might be a naive read of something, but I actually like that book, in addition to being like hilarious, like she's so funny, like laughing out loud on an airplane funny. It actually also for me opened up a well of empathy that I like didn't have access to, and made me really, 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 really look at people quite differently.
That's interesting. I love that. Okay, I'll find the name of it. I'll link to it. Lindy White is
Lindy West.
Oh, Lindy West.
You're gonna be obsessed with her.
I can't wait. Okay, what are some books that maybe you're looking forward to reading?
Yeah, a few. My husband just read this book, How Democracies Die.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, really I mean, for like 4 days, he like went into that book glaze where like nothing else mattered except for this book.
Okay.
And I think it's on, you know, in the like, let's figure out the mythology of the moment
right
we're in.
Sure.
It feels like a really good one. I'm also, I'm excited to read this book, Citizen, the Claudia Rankine.
Yes. Oh, I have that. It's on my nightstand.
Which is also... what this is like my husband's book list, but he's got good taste. And then Kate Bornstein, who is a trans activist and icon, she wrote a book called Queer and Pleasant Danger, a memoir that I'm very excited about. It's sort of next on the list.
This is a little bit off topic, but I guess it probably will fit in. What's next for you for work? And are there any books for that that you're... I mean, first of all, can you talk about future projects? But also, just is there anything that you're reading for work, possibly?
Well, it's funny. I mean, the next new project, I'm doing some things that I have done before, but the next new project that I'm doing is I'm doing a musical adaptation of the movie Dave, which is a movie from the 90s. It's so funny and dear. It's a movie from the 90s with Kevin Kline and Sigourney Weaver about a guy who, as a side job, impersonates the president.
Oh, wait, I do remember that movie.
It's like a movie that everybody had on their VHS shelf, like right next to Man of the House and Beethoven.
And A League of Their Own.
That's right.
My favorite film ever made.
It's of that. You like know what the poster looks like.
Yes.
Anyway, and he ends up actually swinging in to kind of act as the president in a moment of national crisis.
Oh, okay.
But it's like a true political satire.
Okay.
It's very, very funny. And, you know, it's no coincidence that we're doing it in 2018.
Got it.
And we're doing it in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
So... oddly, the sort of like the rabbit hole of it is very similar to the rabbit hole of Soft Power, though tonally they're very, very, very different.
Okay.
So I'm kind of excited to deep dive into. I need to do this work for myself. I want to like really read some things that are like, this is what it means to be in DC.
Okay, like, so listeners, If you have books, this is what it means to be in DC Books.
And not like Lonely Planet. I'm talking about like...
Of course.
You know, like what is the Fire and Fury of 20 years ago?
Sure. Okay, so send your DC related books to Sam. I'll also put his social media accounts. You can just harass him or you can message me either way.
I want to read about the first Bush White House.
Ooh.
Boof.
Yeah. Well, didn't Colin Powell have like some great autobiography in the 90s?
Oh, yeah.
I feel that he did. Okay. Let's move on. How do you pick your next book?
I take a recommendation very seriously. Okay. I think that it's a big commitment to read, you know, 500 pages, especially mm-hmm. if you're working 97 hours a week, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. or 97 hours a day, as most people are. Mm-hmm. So if somebody's like, you have to read this, mm-hmm. chances are I will do it right away.
But like, how seriously do you take the person into account?
It depends on how much I like them and how much I trust them.
Well, no, for real, because people will be like, oh my God, you have to read this fiction book. It's so great. And I'm like, no, I don't, because I don't like fiction. And yeah. I don't trust that you understand that about me.
Yeah, it's definitely, but like if you, Tracy Thomas, are like, you have to read this book, like that book you recommended the other day, which is called
Men We Reaped.
Yep.
The Jessamyn Ward.
Yes.
It was our fourth episode of the podcast.
Yes.
Everybody read it. It's so good. It's so good.
Like I bought that book 2 hours later.
Great. Perfect. I also bought the book you recommended me, That There Are Things More Beautiful Than Beyonce.
I saw it on your Instagram.
I'm so excited.
It's so good. Morgan Parker.
Yes.
So I take that super seriously.
Sure.
And then also, as I said, like work dictates reading assignments. Sure. And I love that. And it also like, I'm aware that that's not actually part of my job. Like I'm not going to get bad marks if I don't do that, but it does encourage me to read. And right. the recreation of reading is so meaningful to me.
Yes, of course.
That makes me feel like I'm not just a total waste.
Yeah. So you take a recommendation seriously. What's something that you love to recommend to people?
This is maybe an eye roll, okay. but I do, especially for young people, I recommend Patti Smith's Just Kids.
Oh, you recommended it to me. I've still never read it.
What?
I know. I didn't take it. That's a book that just didn't make me excited.
I understand that. I mean, it's, there are things about it that are, that can be read as like cliche, but also it's real. Like, and I don't know. I think it definitely is in the Catcher in the Rye category okay. of like, there's a moment to read that book
oh, okay.
or there's a moment to return to it. I always give it to, like, if I have young people working with me, I always give that to them as a gift. Mm. I also recommend, Free for All, which is the Joe Papp. It's the book about Joe Papp and the creation of the public theater.
Oh, okay.
Which is like, I believe strongly, not entirely for theater people. I think okay. it's about democracy, and it's about public art, and it's about like, what does it mean to have a city that has incredibly diverse and opposing positions and humans, and how do you speak to as broad a group of people as possible, which sure. is like my jam.
Right. Interesting. Okay. What's the last really good book that someone else recommended to you?
I'm embarrassed because I haven't finished it yet because
okay.
I'm a monster. But my friend Maggie K. Coleman insisted that I read Lincoln and the Bardo,
oh, okay.
by George Saunders, which, of course, you know, people are probably tired of hearing about.
People love that book. I won't read it.
I don't think it's for you.
It's not for me. I can tell. I read it's like creative, poetic, like historic fiction. I was like, goodbye. I gotta go.
I was so excited. And then I gave up.
Sure.
But I think it is.
You think it's good.
I hold the recommendation steady, okay. and I okay. promise I'll finish it.
What about a good gift? A good book you received as a gift from somebody?
I think it's two things. Whoever gave me Martha Graham's autobiography, Blood Memory, mm-hmm. Like shook me up when I was 17. Like shook me up. And the other book is my friend, the amazing Michael Friedman, who is unfortunately no longer with us, gave me The Complete Works of James Merrill, who is a poet. And when I got it, I was like, why are you giving me this giant, horrible book of poetry by this like white guy from Westchester? And I got like 3 pages in and was convulsively weeping. Okay. And it is definitely the book that made me realize that I don't hate poetry. Mm. And has continued to be a reference point. And it's also now a book that I always gift people.
Well, that's
and nice. Whenever I give it to them, they're like, thanks. And you can like tell they're going to donate it tomorrow. Uh-huh. But it's super meaningful.
That's nice. That's lovely. Okay. So you don't read poetry. Are there any genres that you do? Well, now you do. But are there any genres that you love or that you hate?
I mean, as mentioned, I really love books about cults.
Okay.
I really love books about, like, you know, weird corners of religion.
Yeah. It's kind of the Joint Studio Book Club, our former book club. It's kind of our wheelhouse.
Yeah. I love a richly investigated nonfiction.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Like rich.
Mm-hmm. What's one that is jumping out?
Columbine is the first book that I think about, which I'm so obsessed
with.
That
is a book that I recommend, and it is so incredibly good. We read that. That was like our second Joint Studio Book Club book. That's also the name of our book club, Joint Studio Book Club, which doesn't make any sense to any of you, but it means something to us, and that's all that matters. And even if we explained it, it wouldn't make sense.
No.
It's college stupid things. But anyways, we read Columbine by Dave Cullen. It is amazing.
Yeah, it's like the gold standard of that kind of book. I don't know. I don't even know what you would call that genre, but I do feel like it's a genre.
Sure. It's like a true crime. Like, it's like, but it's like a reflective true crime.
Yeah.
It's less about the crime and more about why this happened. And those kind of books are often done after the documents have been unsealed, which was the case with Columbine. Another book that's amazing that falls into that category is Blood in the Water by Heather Ann Thompson.
Yes.
Did you read it about Attica?
No.
Sam.
You told me about it.
Oh my God. It's so good. You guys, it's huge when it comes. You're going to be like, why did they recommend this giant book? I'm telling you, I read it in 3 days. I stayed up overnight. I had dreams about Attica. It is in that same line of Columbine where it's like she did all this insane research and then like breaks down the story and gives you motivations and gives you all this information. And it's those kind of books for me personally are the reason that books exist.
Yes. And it's different because it's not reporting.
Right.
Like it's Murakami's Underground is one too.
Okay.
Where,
oh, yes.
About the gas
Sierra
attacks
gas,
and the
yes.
Tokyo subways. Like it's not reporting, but you get the details in a very nonfiction way, and then you get a zoom out,
right?
And you get what does this mean for humans,
yes.
And what is the poetry of this, and what is the why, and that it is. It's why I read.
Yes, it's totally why I read. Everything else that I read is just like filler in between finding these great books. And even another book that's kind of like that, a little bit different though. It's a little bit more true crime. Is Helter Skelter
for sure?
It's like an earlier brand of it because Vincent Bugliosi, who wrote it, was the prosecutor on the Charles Manson trial. He has a little bit more of that inside information about the case that an author would get after the seals were unsealed later. But it has that same kind of like, this is what happened, but also like, this is kind of what it means and how it fits into the culture. Yeah. Oh,
that's genre.
Columbine.
That's the genre.
That's the genre. I have like
what's
chills.
It called? Maybe people will have recommendations.
The perfect genre. Yeah, if you guys have more. I know I'll Be Gone in the Dark, the McNamara book about the Golden State Killer. I know that people feel very strongly about that book. So I'm thinking that it might fit in that genre. And there are others.
Going Clear, the Scientology
Going
book.
Going Clear.
Oh my gosh.
Oh my God. That would have been like the last Joint Studio Book Club book. Anyways, okay. Are there any genres that you avoid?
Here's the thing. It takes a lot for me to read a classic. And I realize that a classic is not a genre.
No, it is.
But like it, you really have to strong arm me into reading a book that was written before like 1950.
Yeah.
And that is humiliating. And that is why I will live in my stupidity for the rest of my life.
Sure.
But like when people are like, you haven't read Tale of Two Cities. I'm like, I will die having not read Tale of Two Cities.
The
and that would be fine.
The only thing that I will read that's old is Shakespeare. It's like if it's Shakespeare or else like was it written in 2005?
Yeah. It's so embarrassing, but
not exactly true, but close. Okay. Oh, how do you read? I think you're a hard, like a real book person.
I love a book. I really believe in a book. The thing is I'm on airplanes every day. Mm-hmm. And so when you're reading giant books, it becomes stupid.
Right.
So I sadly have a Kindle. I love it. It was $50. I'm grateful for it. But if I read a book on my Kindle that I believe in, I then buy the hard copy and I have it, which my husband does not like.
That's interesting. Okay. Do you ever listen to books?
No, I fall asleep immediately.
Okay. So this is a great time to talk about our sponsor, Audible. No, but the truth of the matter is They are a sponsor and we're very grateful.
Thank
but
you,
the truth
Audible.
Of the matter is I actually didn't like audiobooks and I started listening and it takes a very specific audiobook. The narrator has to be great.
Yeah.
I just listened to Tiffany Haddish's book, The Last Black Unicorn.
I'm so excited to read that.
You should listen because it's her reading it and she's so funny. And I know they have it on Audible. And for our listeners, you get a free 30-day trial plus a free audiobook. All you have to do is go to audibletrial.com/thestacks and then you pick your book and you get it for free and you get your free 30 days.
What?
And the Tiffany Haddish book is really funny and great and she does such a great job and her life is insane and she had a, I mean, I think anybody who's read the book knows she had a pretty rough past in childhood and she's still like is figuring it all out, I guess, as we all are until all of a sudden you're dead. But up until that point, you're still trying to figure it out and she has a really great, you know, outlook and she's funny and she's got some really great stories. So check it out on Audible. I highly recommend the audiobook. I'm sure reading it is lovely, but hearing her in her voice and she does the voice. It's just, she's
I'm going to do this right away.
Yeah, yeah, do it.
Can I make an Audible shout out?
You can.
Actually,
yeah.
To sort of make up for the fact that I just said that I hate audiobooks.
Yeah, go ahead.
Do you know about that Audible is doing, it has a like theater division now?
Where they do plays?
This is so exciting.
Wait.
So there is this amazing David Cale play called Harry Clark that they just did in New York starring Billy Crudup.
Oh.
It's a one-man show. It was directed by the great Lee Silverman, who is the director of Soft Power.
Oh.
Everything is connected.
Yes, we're
and
all
it
together.
Was produced by Audible.
Oh.
And I don't know if this is real, but like I have to believe that there's some kind of like Audible thing
okay,
coming
we'll look
out.
Into it.
And they're about to do one with Carey Mulligan called Boys and Girls.
Are they all one people
they're
plays?
One people plays
so
that are like
they just
very text
also
driven.
Also do a recording of it too.
Yeah.
I'll look into it.
I think it's like kind of the future. Like I think in 10 years when we're like going to these like audiobook play things, we're going to be like, remember when they broke ground in 2018.
And then
so
you're
going
to be able to go see a show and then be able to listen to it. And
with
like
the
envision
yes.
it in your mind. That's really cool. So Audible's cool, you guys. So go get your free 30-day and your free book, www.audibletrial.com/thestacks, and enjoy. Okay, that was so easy.
Yay, Audible.
Yay,
sorry,
Audible.
I don't like audiobooks.
It's okay. I don't either, but these ones sometimes are really good. Okay, so I know you kind of mentioned this a little bit, but it sounds like you like to read on an airplane.
I love to read on an airplane.
Yeah?
Do
you
oh my
like
gosh.
To
I can
read
one
else?
Whole book on an airplane. Because I live in New York, like transit is really the thing.
Okay.
Like I live in New York and the MTA is run by like kitten, like blindfolded kittens. So like you can pretty much guarantee that any commute's going to take between like 3 and 5 hours.
Also, Sam has kittens on his shirt right now, so it's even better.
You know, just trying to stay relevant.
Yeah, just all ties together.
So I read the most in transit. Okay. I have a heart. I really like, if I sit down and I'm not talking, I basically fall asleep immediately.
Okay.
So I'm not like a cozy up in my book corner.
Got
like
it.
That's just called like a bed and where it's where you
that's
sleep.
That's where you sleep. And do you, wait, I forgot my question. I was going to ask you about reading books, kittens, falling asleep. I can't remember. Maybe it'll come to me later. That was good. So being an interviewer is really important. okay. What was the last? Oh, perfect. We're laughing. What was the last book that made you laugh?
It was Fire and Fury.
Okay.
It's like watching Dynasty. Like
okay.
It is the trashiest, most delicious, ridiculous.
Were you laughing
thing.
At the content or were you laughing at the typos? Because I've heard there's a lot of those.
There are typos. It's like the book, the first draft of the book was written in crayon.
Okay.
I was also laughing at the content though. Like you just, it is so terrifying, but also it was such a release to actually feel like, to get this picture of the White House that's basically like a crazy frat house.
Got it.
With like people running around being like, where are the pencils? There are no pencils.
Oh my God.
You know, whether it's true or not, it was just like it was a relief. Like it felt like I was releasing some kind of tension that I have about our country.
What about a book, the last book that made you cry?
I've mentioned this, but I'm going to tell you, good luck getting through that Comey book without shedding a tear.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Because it is so much about integrity and it's so much about the things that both like make our country what it is and also are impossible. And it's sort of the other side of the Fire and Fury coin.
Okay.
Yeah, it's tough.
Okay. What about the last book where you feel like you learned a lot?
I mean, to speak to our like favorite genre, the first book that I think of where I really learned a lot was actually this book, Outrage, that I know we both love, which is the Vincent Bugliosi book about OJ.
So good.
And I mean, this is again, like one of the reasons why I love reading. I will say until I read that book, I was like, yeah, OJ. But I actually like didn't understand the how and the why, or why it was so different than anything that came before it. Like I was, you know, pretty young when it happened. Mm-hmm. So that book put this like massive cultural moment in a frame for me that I carry with me. Like I actually, I'm not a scholar on OJ, but I actually feel like at a dinner party, I can talk about OJ for 10 minutes.
And also we read this book long before the FX show and the documentary. And it was like kind of, I would say it was probably like 2009 that we read it. So it was kind of long enough after OJ that OJ wasn't that big of a deal in the moment. And it was kind of, I think it was maybe even before he was back in jail for the whole thing.
Nobody was talking about
OJ. Nobody was talking about him. And we loved Helter Skelter, so we picked up a different Vincent Bugliosi book. It is a really good one. And I did feel like I learned a lot, and it made more sense. And now seeing all the OJ things that have come recently in the last few years, I frame them through what I learned in the Outrage.
Yeah, it's also, I just love if I'm like, I'm trying to understand this moment in history, I'm trying to understand this thing. Like, I love starting from a place of like, this is the book that you should read.
Yes, totally.
To just like, which doesn't mean that you're then going to be a scholar on it.
But it gives you a good sense.
Yeah.
It's like a good grounding. Are there any books that you feel proud about having read?
I think there's only one answer to that question.
Okay.
And that is War and Peace, which I have read more than once.
No.
Well, because I did this musical.
I thought you hated classics.
I do hate classics. War and Peace is amazing. The Russians are different.
Okay.
Because the
Russians
throw
are
down.
Beloved on this podcast. Every guest so far has said Anna Karenina, Crime and Punishment,
yes.
Now War and Peace, the Russians.
It is like deep feeling, high stakes, fast moving. They're Russian. They'll kill you.
Sure. I've never read a single Russian thing.
When I started working on Great Comet, which is an adaptation of War and Peace.
Got it.
Obviously, I was like, I have to read
War and Peace.
And I loved it.
Okay. And you got a Tony nomination for your work on that show. So
thanks, Tolstoy.
Thanks, Russians. Appreciate you. Okay. What about a book that you're embarrassed to have read?
I'm just going to tell you that I do own and have read Patti LuPone's autobiography. And I actually remember really enjoying it.
So something else we've discovered on the show is that the book that you're embarrassed to have read also says a lot about who you are, because generally people pick books that they think don't fit who they are, but tend to be exactly who they are.
I remember actually for like a week after I read it, I recommended it to some people, and I could tell by the look on their face that I was not allowed to do that.
Got it. Okay. What about a book you're embarrassed to never have read?
I've never read Of Mice and Men.
Oh,
and
Steinbeck.
I have had so many people tell me that it's like their favorite book.
I never read it. I read The Pearl in school and was like, that's enough.
So boring.
Gotta go.
Oh my. Of Mice and Men, I think is that. And People's History of the United States, I've never read.
Oh, I did read that.
Yeah.
That's right up your alley. Too.
I know.
It's just history.
I know.
Yeah, it's good. What about a favorite book from childhood?
I think the one that I read over and over and over again was Lois Lowry's The Giver, which I was obsessed with.
Sure, one of the greatest.
And which I think like kind of falls into our mutual love of like underground
like
cult
religion, like something's not right.
It was
here.
A primer for a life of really dark reading.
I know, I like that and like Anne Frank, which basically leads me to how I am now.
Yep.
What about a book where you saw yourself reflected back?
You know, it's weird, and it's funny because it's connected to the Versace book that we're going to talk about. But when I think only about like books about queer coming of age, which is so funny because rarely in my life am I like moving around like I'm queer. I want to make sure you know. There's a few books which I haven't revisited since I was a teenager. But I'm Not Myself These Days.
Okay.
Which is, I think, don't remember the writer.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Kirk Reed's How I Learned to Snap.
Okay.
And Fun Home, actually.
Oh. Was that a book before it was a musical?
It's a graphic novel.
I didn't know that.
It is a masterpiece. And I read it long before it was a musical. And they all actually, like, I think that if I revisited How I Learned to Snap, I think I would be a little like, but at the time, especially as a gay kid from the South, where good luck.
Yeah.
They just articulated, a kind of a gritty survival and hilarity that was, something that I needed at the time that I read them.
Amazing. Okay. Do you have any authors that you love or favorite authors?
There are authors that when they come out with something new, I will drop everything and read it. I feel that way about Murakami.
Okay.
Like absolutely anything Murakami. I felt for a while, this is like white guy with cool looking glasses answer, but like there was a while where I was like, I'll read anything Dave Eggers does.
Okay.
I now have like a little bit of a distance from him.
I love Dave Eggers, but I also am not, I loved What Is the What? And I loved Zaytoven. And then I went and read A Staggering Work of Heartbreaking Genius. And then I was like, I don't like this person anymore. And that's the book that's like about his life.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has a new book that I'm like flirting with, but I just feel like there's so much other stuff I want to read.
That is, yeah, that's how I feel. And What Is the What and Zaytoven are definitely the ones. And then I also feel like I've been thinking so much in the last few years, especially with my own work or with performance, of like, who's telling whose stories?
Right.
Like, what are the stories that we're telling and who is supposed to be telling those stories? Right. Not supposed to be, like, who do I want to be telling those stories? And sometimes with Dave Eggers, who, like, if Dave Eggers walked in right now, I would be like, I love you, I'm such a big fan. Yeah. But sometimes I'm a little like, are you the best person to tell that story?
Sure.
Has somebody else told that story who is closer to that experience?
Right.
So it's tricky.
It's tricky. No, I totally agree. I agree with that. I think it's important who tells whose stories, and also whose stories do we get presented with, like through publishing? Like, why isn't the story that is told to a black woman or a Japanese woman and then, you know, written, being published, right? Like, why is it going through the lens of Dave Eggers' white manness?
Well, and it's like, I can say like, What Is the What is one of my favorite books of all time because it is. And also I can step back and say like, wow, it kind of sucks that like the only book that I've really read about Sudan is written by Dave Eggers.
Sure. Agreed.
Like,
agreed.
And that doesn't make that book any less spectacular.
No, it doesn't. Well, just not that this book is exactly the same, but there's a book that just came out called The Girl Who Smiled Beads. And it's written by, her name is Clementine Wayamara, I believe. And she is a Rwandan refugee who travels from Rwanda during the genocide as a child with her little sister, or her big sister, excuse me. She's a little sister. And they go through seven African countries, like from 1994 to 2000. And then they end up in America. And it's her story. And it's written by her and Elizabeth Weil, I believe is her last name.
Okay.
But it's really good, and it's in that same vein of like a refugee story. But her story is less about the Rwandan genocide and more about what is genocide as a word mean to the greater humanity, and like telling your story and finding your words and making – so she's making meaning out of this struggle in a different way, whereas like I felt the Dave Eggers book is more presented as – just
it's a story.
Yeah, a story. And also the thing that's interesting is that her book, Clementine's book, is her and a writer, whereas the Dave Eggers book is like, Dave Eggers wrote this, which is just interesting.
Yeah, for sure.
It's not his story, but it's like Dave Eggers
as
told to, versus this book is like these two women, one is the writer and one is the storyteller, and it's together. And it says both, it says Clementine and Elizabeth. Like it's very clearly, there's been a shift since What Is the What
for sure.
to where we are now. This book came out April like 18th or something. So just like a month ago. It's really good. I have it. You can take my copy. Okay. We're almost finished. But I do have some of my favorite questions now. What is a book that you would recommend to our current United States president? What's a book, if you could, that you would require our president to read? Let me say it that way.
Well, of course, my first question is, can he read?
No, we don't know.
Okay, great.
We don't know. But great. He could get it on Audible.
Oh, yeah.
With his stacks code.
I hope I'm thinking of the right book. But the first thing that comes to mind is that Dr. Seuss book, The Sneetches. Do you know that?
No.
It's so amazing. I mean, first of all, like, I want to aim low.
I think he could handle Dr. Seuss.
But it's basically like how I learned about diversity when I was like seven. Okay. Like, it's basically like, why does everybody hate the Sneetches just because like their house is not that big?
Got it.
It's amazing. It's like total anarchy, and it is. It's like because it's Dr. Seuss. It's like a really absurd look at it. It turns a lens on how absurd it is to feel anything other than like total love for people who, you know, don't look like you.
Got it.
Hello.
Hi.
Maybe check that out.
Great.
Mr. President.
Okay. So the last little thing here we do is the Diversify Books Challenge, which is something that I created because as I started being involved in the book community, I realized that a lot of the same books were getting a lot of play. And while not all of them were written by heterosexual, cisgendered white men, many of them were, and many of them were also written by heterosexual, cisgender white women. And so I just wanted to kind of find a way to incorporate different books. Also, a lot of them were fiction, and a lot of them were being sent by these major publishing houses. So books from Harper Perennial were getting all the love, right, et cetera. So I was trying to find a way to kind of bring a little bit more diversity. So with all my diverse guests on the show, I like to talk about diverse books. So you just give me the answer. You don't have to talk too much about the books. What's a book that you love from before social media days?
That is most definitely The Fire Next Time, James Baldwin.
So good. A book you love by a person of a different ethnicity from you.
Going to go back to Murakami.
Great.
And it's Elephant Vanishes, which is short stories.
Okay, amazing. What's a book you're looking forward to reading by or about people of color?
I am very excited. I just got it to read, tied to what I just said, actually, to read The Fire This Time by Jesmyn Ward.
You know, she's beloved on this podcast by me. Love her.
Yeah.
Love her. A book you love that you rarely hear people talk about.
This does not fall under the diversity category.
It's okay. It doesn't have to fall under diversity.
Great. The book that I love that I really hear people talk about is DV, which is Diana Vreeland's autobiography, who like founded the Costume Institute at the Met.
Is she a lady?
She is a lady.
Well, that's diversity.
The first sentence of the book is, I loathe nostalgia.
Perfect.
And it sort of goes from there.
Got it. A book you loved from a genre that you don't normally read, and then whatever that genre is.
Yeah, my first answer would be Persepolis.
Oh, a lot of people actually said that on Instagram.
I mean, Persepolis and Fun Home are the only graphic novels that I have a relationship to. And that book, like, messed me up. And the form of it felt so essential.
Okay, I love that.
I don't usually go for a graphic novel thing.
Okay, yeah. Great. Do you have anything else that you want to say to the people today, Sam Pinkleton?
Tracy Thomas is the reason that I read. Tracy Thomas is the like reading tsunami of America.
Wait, the most hilarious thing is that every time I ask anybody to say anything else, they all talk about me. Like, what about you?
Yeah, because I feel like you've like mobilized a community of readers.
I appreciate it. That's my only goal in life is to just make more people read and talk about books. So that's amazing. We're all set for now. We will be back next week talking about Maureen Orth's book, Vulgar Favors, The Assassination of Gianni Versace. So yes, go to your Audible, get your free trial, audibletrial.com/thestacks, and we will see you next week. Bye. All right, everybody, that does it for us this week. Thank you so much for listening. Thank you to Sam for being our guest, and thank you to Audible for being our sponsor. Get your free audiobook download and 30-day trial by going to audibletrial.com/thestacks. Also, make sure that you're subscribed to The Stacks wherever you get your podcasts, and if you get us through iTunes, please rate and review the show. We also would love to hear from you, so feel free to contact us through our website, which is www.thestackspodcast.com. There are links in the show notes and also on the website for all of our social media handles, and we'd love to hear from you whichever way you like the most. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite. Our theme music comes from Tagirigis, and this show, The Stacks, was created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas. Thank you all so much for listening, and I will see you in The Stacks.